listing of the Pacific walrus may be warranted under the Endangered Species Act. Maybe? Yep. After a comment period and within a year, we'll know. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we embark on an experiment of using the resources of the statewide public radio system to seek the comments of those who know Pacific walrus on the record. You can call 1-800-478-8255, toll free. Email talk@aprn.org. Pacific walrus on the record on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. And by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
I think we can all agree that the Pacific walrus is an amazing creature, and it inhabits an environment that people don't necessarily get to be in all that much. So we have a statewide radio program here that reaches people who may have firsthand experience of Pacific walrus, and that makes you, our listeners, to the Alaska Public Radio System, a valuable asset in helping the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service figure out what to do with this Endangered Species Act petition. They have been petitioned to list the Pacific walrus. More than a month ago, they said listing may be warranted, and we're now in the comment period. We're going to take this program and also the telephone numbers, the people that call us, and any information that's provided or any information that is subsequently submitted all goes to the Fish and Wildlife Service for them to use as part of their process. So we specifically want to hear from Alaskans who have personal experience, maybe historic experience of the range of the walrus, the behavior of the walrus, and walrus biology, and so forth, that might be helpful to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in making their determination. And there's three people from that agency with us right now to help explore this issue, but mostly to hear what you have to say. I guess we'll start with Jonathan Snyder, biologist. Jonathan, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, everyone.
So it's great, Jonathan, that you approached us with this idea, and I'm more than happy to help. How can our listeners be of most help to you and your agency?
Well, I appreciate you having us here, Steve. Rural Alaskans have a very intimate knowledge of Pacific walrus. Subsistence culture out there, folks that have used walrus for thousands and thousands of years. And we are hoping that folks can call in here this morning and provide us with information that will help inform us in our decision as to whether or not Pacific walrus require listing under the Endangered Species Act.
Now, I understand that the rules about this comment are not real hard and fast. You people want to get the information, but you would like to have it sooner rather than later. You've got a year to make this decision, and you just as soon get the comments in early, within 60 days of the publication. So that leaves a little more than a month right now for people to make sure this stuff gets right in your faces.
Well, actually, Steve, the 90-day finding on the petition was published back in September, and the 60-day comment period would actually run through November. As you said, we would like to get information sooner or later, but we will accept information from the public and interested parties at any time throughout this process.
Okay, I'd like to turn now to your colleague here, Joel Garlick-Miller, biologist of Fish and Wildlife Service. Hi, Joel.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Alaska.
I guess it's no secret that it's pretty hard to survey a walrus. I mean, used to be you had to have planes. I understand now they're using satellites.
Well, there's been efforts dating back to the 1960s to try to get a handle on the size of the Pacific walrus population. And as you know, walrus are, an ice-dependent species. They range across an enormous range out of the pack ice of the Bering and Chukchi Seas. So trying to get a handle on population size has been challenging. Historically, efforts have been done to survey using fixed-wing airplanes and visual observers. And so we had a series of point estimates from a five-year period dating back to about 1980 or so. We recently conducted a survey in the spring of 2006, and we did utilize a slightly different technology. We're still relying on airplanes, but we ended up using some thermal sensors and scanners to try to survey walruses out in the pack ice, in the spring pack ice of the Bering Sea. And the way this system worked, it allows us to fly at very high altitudes, which means that we're able to survey a much larger area. And so we used this thermal scanning technology to survey vast stretches of the Bering pack ice for animals on the sea ice. And another new innovation that occurred in 2006 was that for the first time we made an effort to account for animals that were in the water at the time of the survey. Now, historically, we were only able to obviously see the animals on the sea ice, but using satellite telemetry devices, we're able now to look at animals' behavior and diving behavior in the water and try to account for those animals that weren't hauled out, availably seen.
Now, I guess the basics of this are that the reason that Center for Biological Diversity, and I guess other organizations as well, submitted this petition was because the sea ice has been withdrawing. And it's also fairly, walrus, as you say, are sea ice dependent. We probably need to go into that a little bit at this point, because as I understand it, the males behave very differently than the females when it comes calving time.
The walrus are associated with sea ice for various parts of their life history, and they have a breeding season in the broken pack ice in the Bering Sea, in the lee of islands and headlands in these areas we call polynyas, areas of open water. And so breeding occurs in the winter months, and during springtime, the sea ice begins to recede northward. It migrates north through the Bering Strait and situates itself up along the shallow continental shelf waters of the Chukchi Sea. Now, many male walruses remain behind during the ice-free period in the summer months in the Bering Sea, and they utilize land-based haulouts in Bristol Bay and in the Gulf of Anadyr over in Russia. And so they spend the summer months foraging out in the center of the bay and then coming to shore to rest at terrestrial haulout sites there. Traditionally, females and their dependent young have followed that receding pack ice through the Bering Strait and have spent the summer out over the shallow continental shelf waters that extend north of Alaska, off the North Slope and Chukotka, Russia. There's a shallow shelf that is highly productive and has lots of benthic invertebrates. Walruses feed on clams and other bottom-dwelling creatures there. And the sea ice has serves as a platform for these animals to rest between their feeding bouts and nurse their young so they can just roll over and dive to the shallow bottom to feed. So there's a seasonal separation of a lot of these animals.
And then the females, and are they pups? Or are they?
We call them calves.
Calves. Yep. They may, if the sea ice is withdrawn into deeper waters, we might have a problem. Right?
Well, yeah. Six of the last 9 years, we've come into a situation in the late summer where the sea ice is retreated north off of this shallow continental shelf over deep Arctic water basin waters where animals may not be able to feed.
And so as I understand, just because I want to get to the comments here.
Sure.
We have come to a situation where many years there will be a whole lot of females with their calves and they'll be on shore as opposed to being on the sea ice. And we're not really entirely sure, are we, as to how survivable that situation is in terms of getting enough food and so forth.
That is the challenge of our status review, is to make that sort of forecast about what might happen to the population under the changing sea ice conditions.
Now, you know, as a field biologist, I'm sure you're acquainted with situations where, you feel compassion toward an animal that is in a difficult situation. It almost has to be. It's maybe one of the reasons you're in the business. But what we're dealing with under the Endangered Species Act, as I understand it, has to do not with an individual animal, but it has to do with the population of the animals. I think we'll turn now to Charles Hamilton of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Charlie, maybe you can explain under the law, the Endangered Species Act, what has to be documented in order to get a listing. It has to be that there is a population, A, as I understand it, and B, that this population is affected or could be affected.
Thanks, Steve, and good morning, Alaska, and thank you very much for having the opportunity to come in. And that's a good point that you brought up, and in some ways what Joel was mentioning also comes to bear on why we're here. Some of the things that we're seeing are relatively new. The last few years, the walrus females with calves are coming to shore, and these are things that we are starting to document, but we're interested in finding out what people have been observing, possibly out in the farther reaches, if there have been behavioral changes, how might some of these changes be impacting the walrus that people are observing. Because under the ESA, we have to look at essentially five criteria for listing. One of them is is there changes in habitat? Is there loss of habitat that could be impacting the walrus negatively? Are there appropriate regulations in place to protect the walrus? Is the take of walrus contributing to their decline? Are there disease or predation factors going on? And all of these things, especially things with change in behavior, change in habitat, possibilities of disease, could be impacting the walrus. And some of these things may be very new, and we may not have them well documented. So we're hoping that some of the information could come in from your visitors today on things that they're observing out in the field.
Thank you. That is a good segue to the telephone number, which is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. That's statewide and toll-free. If you're calling from Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is here. The subject is Pacific walrus on the record, and we are specifically looking for people who have observations about walrus. You know, we're not saying don't call up and talk about climate warming and carbon dioxide and theories of climate warming and so forth, but we're saying what's most useful to our guests today is observations that people have about walrus and the things that Charlie was just talking about, like are they changing their behavior, in what way, what have you seen? And I guess even down to the point, Joel, of what they eat. You get some idea of what they eat, right? But, that there may be observations for that.
Certainly. Points raised in the petition is not just the loss of sea ice habitat, but potentially broad-scale ecological shifts in prey densities and things like that. And so, yeah, we have some limited information from stomach content analysis. Hunters have helped us sample walruses for many years now, but there potentially are. We don't have a full understanding of the full ranges of food.
All right. Well, our first call has come in already from Barrow. Thomas joins the program from Barrow. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Thomas.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you, Thomas. Could you turn your radio down a little bit there, because we're getting a delay effect there.
I don't have a radio on.
Okay.
My question is, if the walrus put on the endangered species, will that put a stop to sales of ivory carvings and as such by the subsistence hunters?
That's a great question. I'm sure you're not the only person thinking that.
That's how we make our money up here, being a subsistence hunter and then working on the ivory after. And if they put a endangered species list, will that put a stop to us hunting the walrus or put down a quota? And how long before that comes into effect?
All right, Thomas. Thank you. Jonathan, can you help Thomas out with this one?
Sure. Hello, Thomas. I guess I would start out by saying that both the Endangered Species Act and the Marine Mammal Protection Act provide for subsistence use of Pacific walrus by Alaska natives. So the creation and sale of authentic native handicrafts is a recognized and legitimate subsistence activity. So that is covered under both the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act. As far as thinking about quotas or anything like that, I think that's a little bit early in the process for that. As Steve has said, we are just beginning our status review to determine whether or not Pacific walrus are in need of Endangered Species Act protection. Should we find that that walrus are in need of listing, we will certainly work with our co-management partners, the Eskimo Walrus Commission, to address any sorts of issues related to subsistence harvest and the creation and sale of authentic handicrafts.
Thomas, you still with us?
Yes, I still am.
All right, Thomas, I want to toss this question to Joel Garlick Miller as well. Do we have any indication of what proportion of walrus are harvested in a subsistence manner?
Well, I have been challenged, as we started to talk about earlier, about trying to determine the total population size. So it is very difficult to specifically talk about how many walruses, what part of the walrus population is harvested on an annual basis. We see enormous fluctuations year to year of walrus harvest. The success of hunters, of course, depends on having the right hunting conditions, the right ice conditions. Now, historically, there have been periods of time where hunting pressure has probably exceeded recruitment, and there have been some periods historically where walrus populations believed to have dropped as a result of harvest. But these are mostly commercial ventures back in the 1800s and early 1900s. Current harvest levels are quite a bit lower than these historic
Do we know ice. Much about what's going on over on the Russian side in terms of harvest?
We do. We partner with Russian colleagues over there. They have harvest monitoring programs, as we do here in Alaska. And for both the combined harvest of the United States and Russia over the last 5 years is less, some nature of 5,000 animals, Jonathan?
Yeah, 5,000 to 5,500.
And we're looking at a potential population in the hundreds of thousands.
That's correct. Yeah. And so currently, based on, you know, a long history of harvesting, we believe that harvest levels are currently sustainable. And that is not the the nature of the petition. Actually, the petition specifically was identifying concerns over diminishing habitat.
Right. But, so, Thomas, I think, as Jonathan has said, it would be very premature to even look at that possibility.
Yeah, I was concerned because I make my living out of ivy carvings, and if they're going to put a quota and put a stop on sales, if they're endangered, maybe I should bring my prices up now while I can.
All right, Thomas, your comment is on the record, and thanks for calling.
Very much.
Okay. All right. Let's go now to Lars, joins the program from Anchorage, possibly Barrow. I'm not quite sure here. Lars, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. I'm actually here in Anchorage. I'm from Barrow.
Yes.
I just wanted to make an observational comment. One day I was out on a boat, and we saw a walrus in the water, and he seemed to be, he was eating a seal, and he had really yellow tusks, and I don't know if that's a trait of a meat eater, or I'm not sure, but I thought I'd bring that observation.
Lars, do you have a more specific location for that?
Yeah, it was off of the Bering Sea coast.
All right, thank you.
Right off of Barrow.
Okay, so that would be with a Chukchi then? It's off a barrel.
It was off the. Well, we were in the Bering area. It's right to the left is Chukchi. Right to the right is the Bering.
So. Beaufort. The Beaufort. Yes.
I'm sorry, the Beaufort. Yeah.
It's all right. Not the first time that's happened. Okay, Lars, thank you. Does anyone of the biologists want to chime in? Jonathan?
Sure, yes. Thank you for that comment, Lars. Walrus preying on seals is not a super uncommon event. Traditional native knowledge tells us that these are animals which were orphaned at a very young age and never learned from their mothers what they are supposed to eat. That would be clams and other benthic invertebrates. So the observation of very yellow tusks, we've heard that from subsistence hunters in the past, and they say that that's an accumulation of seal oil on the walrus's tusks that turn them that color, and that oil apparently very often accumulates on the chest of the animal and can impart somewhat of a bad odor, I guess.
Lars?
Yeah, wow. That's good to finally put that together. I wasn't sure what was going on there, but that's a good explanation.
All right, Lars. Well, thank you very much for your call and for your observation. We're talking about Pacific walrus on Talk of Alaska on the record. Because this is a statewide show and we're reaching people with firsthand experience, we really encourage you, if you do have such experience, to call, as people so far have, at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling from Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422, and email can come in pretty handy. It's talk@aprn.org. And what we would like to do is share your telephone numbers with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they would be happy to follow up and call people back and get more detailed information. And this is all going into the public record as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service considers a petition to list under the Endangered Species Act the Pacific walrus. Yeah, Jonathan.
Yes, Steve, I'd just like to let folks know that there are various ways that folks could submit information to the Fish and Wildlife Service right now. One of your options is to go to the federal e-rulemaking portal. If you have internet access, that can be found at www.regulations.gov. And you can search for walrus on there, or search for the docket number FWS-R7-ES-2009-0051, and then follow the instructions for submitting comments.
And we can put a link for that, if you want, on our website, too, if people want to go in on that.
That would be great. Okay. Folks could also go to the Fish and Wildlife Service website and find a link to that rulemaking portal. I'll also throw out our 800 number for the Fish and Wildlife Service Marine Mammals Management Office. It is 1-800-362-5148. You're welcome to go ahead and give us a call.
Okay. Yeah, that is Jonathan Snyder of the Fish and Wildlife Service, a biologist. Also, Joel Garlick-Miller, a biologist, is with us. And Joel, maybe we can get just a basic description of how the walrus uses the tusks.
Sure, yeah.
Because we just heard a caller with an observation of using the tusks for predation, and we heard that's not unusual. Well, it is unusual, but it has been seen, but that's not the customary way that they would actually predate on a large animal. They're usually more kind of digging around in the muck, aren't they?
Well, walruses, yeah, they feed primarily on benthic organisms, things on the seabed, soft shell organisms and clams and things. The tusks, as we understand it, aren't really used to root out the food down on the ocean bottom. Usually, they use they have big whiskered faces, and they use these highly sensitive whiskers to search the ocean bottom for prey items, and then they can use their flippers or jets of water to try to dislodge their prey, and great suction. They have enormous suction, so they can just vacuum the ocean floor. But where the tusks really come in handy, both sexes have them, and Odo Benus, their Latin name, talks about tooth walker, and they use these tusks as sort of as ice picks to drag their massive carcasses up onto ice floes and things like that. And the tusks also come in very handy as defensive weapons, and also they often use them just as ritualistic threat displays to settle their differences. Thanks.
This is fun. I mean, I like the whole science of this. It's really cool because I mean, rarely do you get to see one of these in their habitat, and to get all this observation is really enjoyable to me. Let's go to Stu, who joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stu.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, guys, Cook Inlet. I've written letters. I believe that Joel sent them emails. Yeah, we have walrus, or at least one walrus out here.
In Cook Inlet?
Yes. Don't act surprised. I mean, it's been on the front page of the Daily News. Come on. Anyhow, I like to paddle out with my kayak and take a look at him. And Drift River, north side, is where he hangs. And I've been up and down Calgon Island and the west side of the Cook Inlet talking to set netters. And I think Fish and Game needs to go out and talk to those guys, especially the ones that have been around for over half a century. On Calgon Island, North Shore, specifically Janet and Vanus, and those guys, they have told me that there's been breeding populations in Cook Inlet, and they were just overhunted. And I'd also like to question your ice-dependent argument. It seems like in Cook Inlet, with the super fast tides, you know, I've watched him out on the mud, and the tide comes in, and he just rides it around at his own free will. They don't seem to need the ice. So I would suggest that maybe as their habitat vanishes where they do need the ice, Cook Inlet potentially could be a place where, if they could keep people from shooting them and have a haul-outs where they aren't bothered, could be a place where they might be able to continue indefinitely.
Fascinating comments, too.
Well, I'd like to hear what Joel has to say about that. And
Thank you for the comment. Yeah, that is a good point. We part of our process will be to look at the current range and extent, and also trying to anticipate future expansion and use of habitat. So, yes, we do have the records of use in Cook Inlet. The reference to breeding populations is new information to me, and I appreciate that. That's the point of this show. We have had reports of one or up to several animals actually in Cook Inlet and surviving. We don't understand if they are connected with the rest of the population or not, but those ones certainly seem to be doing fairly well.
Stu, do you have to be a pretty strong paddler and know what you're doing to be kayaking in Cook Inlet? It's hard for me to imagine.
You know, Shem Pete. You might want to read Shem Pete. He talks in detail about it. But, yeah, the currents are really strong, but the fact is the water totally disappears every 8 hours. So. we either go down to Big Sioux and up there by the Parks Highway and just paddle down there and Well, we go out at Ship Creek, but yeah, the kayaks move quite well out there. You've got to watch the weather and be ready to sleep in the mud, basically. But, you know, there's a variety of duck shacks out there.
Yeah.
And you do get to see the seals and the walrus. And it took a while to find them. If you want to contact the folks at Drift River Terminal, they probably are the best and most knowledgeable about his current location. And but you do need to talk to the set netters on Calgon Island because you know, they have a story, the one they call Wally. He was in the front page of Daily News. They say he's a, like you said, the babies, once they're orphaned, they don't learn how to do things the same way. And the story that I got from the set netters was that they shot his mother. Well, somebody shot his mother, and he was kind of left all by himself. And, by the way, how long do they live? I mean, Wally's been out there for how long? So
that's a great question.
Well, we do age determination by looking at growth layers in their lower canine teeth, and so I guess the oldest one that I've ever looked at was, I think, 45 years old. So they can be incredibly long-lived animals.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like to me. I think they said the mother was shot back in the 70s, and that kind of ended the breeding population. And then there's the feeling I got talking to people was there's an agreement not to shoot Wally. And besides, one of his tusks is broken. Joel, did I send you pictures of him a few years ago? Do you remember that?
Yes, you did. I do have them.
Well, you know, I know that talking about walrus habitat in Cook Inlet probably is very politicized, especially now that we're, you know, we sold all our gas to Japan and we're running out and people want to develop. So, but, you know, if they're losing all their pack ice, maybe they should find a way to, you know, it's really nice having a population to go look at one of these animals, especially when they're out on the mud. Of course, you can't get within, was it 200 yards now or 100?
I don't know.
Well, there's a legal limit, but anyhow, you can get really close to them because
there's
a place for them to go. But, of course, you don't want to get break the law. But, yeah, viewing habitat for walrus is extraordinary in Cook Inlet. And really, if you have the time, you can do it in a, you know, a kayak. That's probably the, you know, best way to move around out there anyhow, if you want to talk to all the locals anyhow.
Stu, thank you for that call. That very outdoorsy call. I really appreciate that. Pacific Walrus on the Record is the subject as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Communications Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is November 2nd. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association.
Well, my old buddy Hobo Jim has this great song, Fishing for Chickens. And what we're doing is we're fishing for your comments about Pacific Walrus. And we're catching some here. This is great. And thanks for playing along on Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. We're looking for people that have firsthand experience, observations of walrus, their historic behavior, unusual behavior we're hearing about, maybe some questions. And it all is helping to inform the process because the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service basically has a year to decide on this petition. And they've decided that there's a possibility that they need to list the Pacific Walrus under the Endangered Species Act. Well, now comes the hard part. Let's get the facts and let's get the numbers. One of the most important set of numbers is not out yet. And that is the one that Joel was talking about earlier, Joel Garlick Miller of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is that survey of using heat sensing that went into both Russian and American waters, as I understand it, and we just don't have the final number, even though it was 2006. What holds that up?
It has been a long process, and it's a novel technique, and we had some snafus with respect to data analysis. When we surveyed in 2006, we chose it for the spring.
I love it. I can tell you've had to say this over and over and over again.
Well, we encountered some colder than expected temperatures, and the thermal scanners that we had utilized worked great in trial runs, but we had to adjust for the colder temperatures. But we've worked through that, and we're almost complete with analysis.
Wow. And so it will be in time for you to use that data in your...
That's right. We will have that information available to us, But in and on itself, the estimate generated from it is we need some context to interpret that, and that's what we're really sort of looking at today. It will be a point estimate that we won't necessarily be able to compare with the past. So we're trying to get input and understanding from those who see walrus regularly in their lives to help interpret that.
Yeah. Well, I would you've already referred to them a couple of times, but Jonathan Snyder, I guess that you guys have worked increasingly more closely with the Walrus Commission in this co-management role. I would imagine they would be helpful in this process.
Yes, definitely, Steve. The Fish and Wildlife Service has a formal co-management agreement with the Eskimo Walrus Commission for co-management of subsistence use of Pacific walrus. And we meet with these folks on a regular basis. We travel out to the communities with them. The current director for the Eskimo Walrus Commission, Vera Metcalf, she's based in Nome. We had invited Vera to join us here this morning. Unfortunately, she had some prior scheduling conflicts.
Yeah, we picked right around the AFM when everybody gets real busy.
it was tough. So, but the Eskimo Walrus Commission has been an excellent partner with the Fish and Wildlife Service.
And I would assume that when we talk about asking for comments, that they'll be among those submitting comments along with basically any interest group. I'm sure the state of Alaska will be weighing in and so forth, the CBD. There'll be no lack of comment, but hopefully we can add just a little different light during Talk of Alaska today. Jonathan came to Talk of Alaska and said, hey, you know, could we use your show to gather public comment? And I said, absolutely, let's give it a try. And you're doing a great job, people, in calling up with very specific information and observations. From Homer, here's Katie. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Katie.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Everybody's doing fine. They're not as nervous, not as nervous as they were when they walked in.
Okay. Hey, I don't have anything really specific observations, but I have gone out to the Togiak herring fishery on herring seiners about four or five times in the last 20 years. And a great resource for you guys, and you're probably aware of this, would be the spotter pilots. And we have a pretty consistent herring fleet that leaves Homer every spring and goes out to seine herring, the month of May. And part of the fishery is that the spotter pilots are flying around and looking for ripe fish in schools. And some of the same pilots have been going out there very consistently, probably in the last 20 years. And I bet they have some, pretty good observations of any change over time. I know the only thing I could contribute personally was we saw quite a few walrus over on Cape Newingham one year. And I remember the skippers that had been around longer said that they hadn't seen that, and they had kind of come in. They felt like the walrus were kind of coming down around that corner a little bit toward Togiak, and then of course I'm sure you know that.
What time of year this would be in herring season, right?
Yeah, this is usually the month of May.
Yeah,
somewhere in there. There's a 2 or 3 week period, and then we'd always see guys from Togiak, local guys, out in their skiffs, and I'm not sure exactly what they're doing, but probably hunting and. So those guys would have, like, some spring duck camps or something out on the spits. So anyway, nothing too concrete for you, but I thought if you weren't already in touch with some of those spotter pilots, I could give you my number after the comment here, and if you wanted to call, I could give you some spotter pilot names.
Katie, thank you so much.
Yeah, that would be... That would be great, Katie. Thank you for your comment. And if you want to leave some contact information with the nice folks here, we will get back in touch with you.
We got it for you, Jonathan. We're all over that puppy. Let's go to Ricky joins the program from Barrow. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ricky.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
How's it going?
Hey, it's going really well. This is kind of an experiment here. I'm happy with it.
Okay. I had an experience with walruses back in 77 when I went walrus hunting with my whaling captain. And I happened to shoot a female one time, and she had a puppy. And my captain said that I would have to shoot the puppy if another walrus didn't come up and adopt him. But anyways, while the pup was sounding his bell calling for his mom, another female came up and tusked it away, adopted it.
I'll bet you were happy about that, Ricky.
Oh, I was so ecstatic. I there was tears streaming down my face. I said, wow, that was the most beautiful sight I ever seen. And, you know, it was just beautiful. Another walrus coming up, you know, it. No matter how many people were standing on the ice, you know, all of us had guns and, you know, without fear, came up right up to the ice edge and took that pup away.
Well, Ricky, I want to thank you for that story.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. It's Talk of Alaska. It's Pacific Walrus on the record. A story from Barrow there, a personal account. Let's go to Ryan in Anchorage. Ryan, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I heard those fascinating comments by that gentleman who was talking about the walrus populations in Cook Inlet. And about 10 years ago, or maybe a little less, I was boating out in Prince William Sound, and I actually saw a walrus out there, and I was just wondering if...
Oh, man, this is getting crazy. Next thing you know, Ketchikan's going to be calling up. Seriously. you're serious about this.
Yeah, no, I saw a walrus. I was out boating with my dad, and I can't remember where we were. We were either in Port Wells or maybe Night Island Passage, and ahead of us there was a big marine mammal, and we're like, oh, it looks like a sea lion. And it stopped, and it turned around, and sure enough, there's two big tusks coming out of the front of its face. And we're like, oh, my God, look at that.
So you say it's about 10 years ago. Jonathan, you ever heard of that in Prince William Sound?
Well, actually, now that you mention it, a gentleman in Cordova, when I was visiting one time, told me that he had many, many years ago had seen a walrus in Port Wells.
Okay. So it might have been around the same time, but yeah. So you guys haven't heard of any other sightings though, besides that?
We get reports occasionally of walruses that you've already heard of, frequent and repeated sightings in Cook Inlet of whether it's one animal or a couple of different animals that's still open for discussion. But the we also had last year a very well documented time flies. It's a couple of years back. We in Seward, there was a young walrus that was hauling out at Thumb Cove, and we have photos showing it too. And where it came from and where it went, we don't know. We weren't able to find out where it eventually ended up.
Yeah, Ryan, thanks for your call. You know, as you have explained, this is actually. This we could see more if there could be habitat displacement, I guess is what I'm saying in biological terms, that we might see walrus trying to explore new environments.
Well, in fact, that is something that we are going to have to consider in our analysis is as the sea ice changes, more specifically up in the north, we see people have been focusing on the loss of sea ice habitat. But there's also opportunities where walruses' range have been restricted by severe ice conditions. There's new habitat potentially opening up across the top of Siberia. And indeed, the Russians' communities there are seeing movements of animals further and further west as sea ice conditions moderate in that area.
Yeah, my head has to twist around to see what west is when you're up in the Arctic,
right.
But
west,
I see what you mean.
Yeah. So, you know, their ranges, in at least in the past 20 years or so, has been quite restricted because of severe ice that lasts year-round. And now animals seem to be moving further and further west. And we're getting more reports also into the Beaufort Sea as well. The walruses do have occasionally migrated east in that way, but we're getting regular reports of small numbers of animals moving that way.
You know, I'm suddenly getting this vision of some genetic evidence that might be handy or get introduced at some point to determine what are the populations? In other words, what's the population unit of a walrus? Is it a different population that's over there on the Wrangell Island side, or is it the same population? Do we know?
Well, we're currently treating and assuming it's a single population of animals that ranges, you know, across the Bering and Chukchi Seas, with the genetic and morphology or body shape indicators are all suggested that it's not discrete breeding groups. However, there are populations to further to the west in the eastern Siberian Sea, and whether or not that was a population that has been isolated in the past is something that we'll have to look at. Both the Russians and a lot of Alaska Native hunters who see walruses also report various waves of migrations of animals with some different characteristics. So there may be some fine scale structure that we need to understand better.
Ryan, you still with us?
Yeah. Well, you know, well, hopefully they turn out to be like the moose, you know, and just kind of spread everywhere. but thanks a lot for your guys' information.
All right, Ryan. Thanks for your account. We're gathering public comment for the Fish and Wildlife Service on Talk of Alaska today about Pacific walrus. If you have some personal experience or some historic experience or some leads on information that might be helpful in making this critical Endangered Species Act termination, listing or not listing the Pacific walrus, we'd really like to hear from you today. The Fish and Wildlife Service would really like to hear from you. There are three of them here today in our studio. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Email talk@aprn.org. And Stephen joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Stephen.
Well, good morning. And this is an issue that myself, as a friend of the folks from Urville or King Island is one that I like to chat a little bit about. I noticed when I went up to Nome and started building a traditional Sitmasauk campsite, at least not that particular year, but 06 was interesting because we saw a lot of, I'm going to make an assumption here that might not be accurate, but more than normal, you know, fall time, September, October, walrus up on the beach. And I got real lucky about a half mile down there in 06 in October. It was a rainy day. I was supposed to be framing my deck, which isn't done yet. Here I got a 10-foot bull belly up right below the bluff, a half mile, about mile 19 and a half, you know, on the Nome Council Road, right below the bluff on the beach and on the ocean side. And so, boy, somebody already got in the test, but I was pronto with that because it was a fresh one, maybe around Labor Day, pronto on that what wound up to be a 10-foot bull and a 21.5-inch oosik for posterity. So next time, if I ever do it again, I'll make sure that I am pronto with my quick with my 30-day listing it, you know, with the folks, the good folks with that handle the walrus, although I did finally list it, but I won't do that again. And they were just saying, you know, the biologists, that we would like our native hunters, you know, to be a little more, put it this way, they're going to be looking more in the future, and I'm sure they already have, because there's so much showing up on the beach. And then just to go on to that, one more thought is, for us to have polar bear sightings down there at safety, you know, Labor Day 07 and mid-June 08, for heaven's sakes, you know, we're not Kiana or Point Hope, so that's kind of interesting. You know, I would say Al might, Vice President Gore might talk about the marginal methane deposits. Some of the poorer politicians have maybe they're the cause of all this. But I'm just saying that it's an area of concern. I know the hunters the last couple of years now, although this year was somewhat better, but they just weren't able to get at the animals that they wanted to on our side. You know, the ones that I know of, and you know, they're dependent on that from King Island, and some things don't change. Although they're not living there, they still hunt. So
yeah,
anyway, that's all I wanted to add. And I'm real concerned about the habitat, and that the proper thing is done with exceptions. And I cite the Japanese, how they treat us in regard to our whaling communities, with the proper exceptions of the diet needs for our native people, as far as the protection is concerned. I would hope that Boogaloo, who's involved on that Pacific Walrus Commission, and others will state their case, and then the authorities will listen.
All right. Thank you, Stephen.
Sure.
That brings up a whole lot of different areas. I know very early in the process of talk of Alaska, Governor Steve Cooper was on here, and we got a caller from, was it maybe on St. Lawrence Island? Probably. And they said, Governor, what you going to do about our lost walrus hunters? And nobody even knew that these people were missing. They hadn't been reported missing. And they call from the village, and they talk to the governor directly on the radio. And the governor says, I'll get right on it. And he calls the adjutant general. The adjutant general sends out a C-130. They find the walrus hunters. But that's some gnarly business, getting out there in that ice trying to hunt a walrus. That is tough stuff. It's Talk of Alaska, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@aprn.org as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by First National Bank Alaska. Branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Pacific Walrus on the Record is the subject today. We're gathering public comment, and we are sharing your phone numbers with the, as you call into the show, we'll pass the phone numbers on to the Fish and Wildlife Service to help them gather further comment about the Pacific Walrus. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-TALK, and if you don't get through on phone, as obviously there are going to be some that don't, just leave your number and they will be calling you back. They're pretty serious about this outreach and getting this firsthand information. We all know, I've read through records of public proceedings, and this is a touchy, let's face it, this is politically is a very difficult issue, and you just know that there's going to be all sorts of spin in all the comments. This is real firsthand comments that people have real firsthand information. And it doesn't, of course, stop with Talk of Alaska. They just want to hear your comment. And how do they do that, Jonathan Snyder?
Well, thank you, Steve. There's a number of ways that folks can comment. Steve has offered to put up a couple of links on the Talk of Alaska website, so I'll just touch here real briefly. But www.regulations.gov, you may go to that website to submit comments and information. You can give us a call at our office at 1-800-362-5148, or you may visit our website at www.fws.gov and search for walrus.
Let's go to Charles, joins the program from Barrow. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Charles.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Jonathan, Joe, and Charles. How are you guys doing?
Good morning, Mr. Brower.
Good morning, Mr. Brower.
Good morning, Mr. Brower.
Good morning, everyone. I just wanted to call in and say, you know, the changes that, you know, is quite obvious is the rookery that's going to happen with the declining ice, and the northern coastals will become more filled with more walruses, as we've known in these past few years. And hopefully in the future that, you know, that the ice will come back. But that's the changes I've seen. And the walruses are still pretty fat and healthy out there in the ocean. But the other concern I have is the management of the Pacific walrus through Wildlife Service and Walrus Commission, the shortage of funds that is not arriving to the Walrus Commission for better management. And I hope that someone from Walrus Commission was online with you guys.
Well, they are just too busy. But we appreciate hearing from you, and I think you've made your point.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I just wanted to thank you guys for being on here.
Well, thank you, Charlie. We appreciate your comments, and we'll take those to heart.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking Pacific walrus, and Brian joins us from Talkeetna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Brian.
Hi, Steve.
How you doing, Brian?
Good. Yeah, I've just I've had the wonderful opportunity to work out at Round Island and observe.
Oh boy! Walrus. Yeah, it's for those that don't know, I guess we should say Round Island is where a whole lot of the male walruses spend their summer. Yes.
Yeah, sometimes there's quite a few there, and other times in the last few summers there's been very low numbers. But just a quick observation and then a question. Despite their massive size, they're very susceptible to disturbance when they're on shore hauled out. They're very social, get into tight pack herds. But if something frightens one or two or a group of walruses, they stampede and head for the water to their safety zone, and then they figure out what's going on. And we've seen things as small as juvenile ravens frighten walrus into stampeding, or rock falls, or low-flying aircraft, or boats in close to shore. And with the walrus using having to use terrestrial haulouts as the ice recedes, is there going to be further protection for them on haulouts along the coast of Alaska?
Brian, that's a fantastic question. We probably don't have an answer. Joel?
Well, we have, there are some ongoing efforts. There currently aren't any refuges or protected areas per se up on the north slope of Alaska where these haulouts have been occurring. But we've been taking efforts to work with local communities and through the FAA to raise awareness about the haulouts and the potential for disturbances. We've worked with the FAA to try to impose flight guidance and restrictions around walrus haulouts as they show up. Now, over in Chukotka, Russia, where we have seen some very large haulouts forming in recent years, several of the communities there have been taking some very proactive grassroots-level conservation efforts to reduce disturbances to walruses hauling out there in very large numbers. They've self-imposed hunting restrictions, not to take walrus, but just not to do it at the haulouts where there's large numbers where disturbances can occur. And they've been lobbied to reroute supply flights into their communities and things like that based on experiences of having disturbances and mortality events. So that is certainly very heartening. And they this winter, we hope to bring some of these community leaders over to Alaska to talk with native leaders here just to talk about ways that people can live with walruses.
Wow. Yeah, bullseye there, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us on Talk of Alaska. Joel Garlick-Miller, Jonathan Snyder, and Charlie Hamilton. I hope this is a success for all of us. And remember, we'll put the link up on our website if you want to submit further comments. The comment period is open, and they have to decide this within a year. Gooseberry Peter at the controls, Len Anderson, BD Trantina, Pat Yak on the phones. Thanks for listening.
Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, fight the flu by washing your hands often or using a hand sanitizer, coughing into your sleeve or a tissue, and keeping sick people at home. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.